KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, you're listening to Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It is a beautiful day in the Seattle area. Perfect time to get out into the garden. Later this hour, we'll be talking with our Green Days gardening panel. They're here to answer your questions. You can email now, weekday@kuow.org. A story in the July issue of Atlantic Magazine takes aim at the nutritional supplement industry. You've probably seen articles and ads about the benefits of everything from probiotics to megadoses of vitamins. According to Atlantic reporter Paul Offit, there isn't a lot of hard scientific data to support industry claims that we actually need supplements to our diets. We decided we wanted to follow up on this, so we invited a couple of experts to talk with us. Registered dietitian Mary Purdy is in the studio with us once again. It's great to see you. And joining us by phone, Dr. Calvin Kwan, a clinical resident at Bastyr Center for Natural Health. Dr. Kwan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I'll start off with you, Mary, since I'm looking at you. When we say nutritional supplements, what are we talking about exactly?
I think there's a wide variety of different supplements out there. So there are the vitamin and mineral supplements that often come in the form of multivitamins, but there's a myriad of other types of supplements that are out there. Herbal supplements, probiotic supplements, fish oil supplements, and a variety of antioxidant compounds that are combined together for certain strategic targeted therapies.
And so, Dr. Kwan, where it gets confusing is, as a person who is trying to maintain a healthy diet, is what is a claim that's accurate, what we should be thinking about when we're confronted by the array of things that tell us we'll be healthier if we ingest them. So what do you recommend?
My general recommendation for my patients, I like to just have them talk to their naturopath or myself. And what I'd like to tell them is, they can feel free to take a look at Google, Dr. Google, or they can talk to me. And what they need to do is just make thoughtful and educated decisions. With that, they can talk to me about how these things might interact with their pertinent or conditions. So, again, I feel it's better to just talk with a professional or medical professional, especially if there's other medications on board.
Are all vitamins and nutritional supplements created equal?
That's a really good question. The Bastyr Center for Natural Health, we actually do extensive research and quality assurance and quality control over the products that we bring into our dispensary. So not all products are made equally, and some products are better, or not better, but more so safer for patients.
Well, that's something that you want to pay attention to. Mary Purdy, you work with nutritional advice. You work with people to try to get diets on board. And one of the confusions, I think, is whether if we eat a healthy diet, we need to add supplements to our diets.
I think it's the most commonly asked question. And then I would love it if our current diet provided all of the nutrients that our bodies need to have optimal function. But I think the reality is that that is not the case. If you were to put somebody's typical diet into a food analysis, a program, it would come up short with a number of vitamins and minerals.
So what do you mean when you say a typical diet?
Oh, typical diet, maybe, some toast for breakfast or a Pop-Tart, maybe a piece of fruit, a sandwich for lunch, very few fruits and vegetables in the typical American diet, or just not enough to actually meet those nutrient goals.
So dietetically, is there a way that we can reorganize what we eat to actually get all the kinds of nutrients and vitamins and minerals that we need?
I would hope so. I mean, increasing your intake of those natural, whole, real foods, brightly colored fruits and vegetables, whole grains, beans, nuts, seeds, herbs, and spices is a great way to at least begin that process. The sad thing is that the quality of our soil right now has been really compromised. So the minerals that would normally be in the soil to provide all those nutrients, they just aren't there in a lot of places. So people are missing out in that way.
Oh, interesting. So even if we eat a carrot, not all carrots are created equal.
They are not all created equally, for sure.
We're talking about vitamins and nutritional supplements with Mary Purdy, a registered dietitian. And also with us on the phone is Dr. Calvin Kwan of Best Ear Center for Natural Health. And Dr. Kwan, one of the things I wondered was whether our bodies absorb nutrients from food differently than from supplements.
There's definitely a talk about bioavailability, about foods and or nutraceuticals. Plants have been around since the ages, since the dinosaurs. Who knows when it's been around? And that's what we've been going by since then. Nutraceuticals didn't come in until recent era, I suppose. So I think eating whole foods is going to be the best way to go. When it comes down to should you take supplements or eat foods.
So how do you judge, I mean, if you've got a patient who has, I don't know, maybe arthritis. I have arthritis, so that just came to mind. How do you balance a diet versus something that you would prescribe for them to take in addition to that diet?
Well, it all depends. Again, when it comes down to medication, some medications are shown or have been shown to decrease nutrients. An example, a really quick one, is simvastatin, or just drugs that have statins. They tend to reduce the nutrients like CoQ10. For arthritis, a lot of these, medications that individuals take can put a lot of strain on the liver and can reduce the antioxidants in that sense. So it's just a coupling of starting from the lowest part of our, therapeutic order, starting with diet, lifestyle, trying to get those in line. And then if that's not working and we need just that extra boost or extra kick in, we'll throw in some supplements or nutraceuticals to help facilitate and promote the patient's health.
One thing that I really want to note here is that a lot of people are dealing with medical conditions that are increasing their needs for certain nutrients. So to put them on some kind of a supplement can help bring them back to a baseline of health. And it may just be a short-term targeted therapy. I think that can be really helpful.
So we've heard a lot, particularly here in the Puget Sound region, about the need for maybe additional vitamin D. I know doctors, you know, MDs prescribe it, that low vitamin D can be tied to aging. We've also heard a lot about sort of the miracles of things like omega-3s, and all that came crashing down, I believe, last week when a new study came out tying too much omega-3 consumption by men to prostate cancer. So I wonder where, to go back to a question, Dr. Kwan, I asked you before, where in that Dr. Google that you mentioned, we can actually look and trust that what we're getting is accurate information.
That's going to be tough. A lot of these databases and research articles are accessible to the public just by searching general databases like PubMed, NIH, places like that. It's where it comes down to, what it boils down to really is just how much education an individual has when it comes to interpreting research data. Again, it's something best left for a medical professional, an MD, an ND, and just have them interpret it for you. I think that's the best idea. I think people run into the trouble when they start self-prescribing and not understanding what interactions that their supplements and or their medications might have with their condition.
Now, Mary Purdy, there are a lot of omega-3s are one fish oil supplements. There's a lot of sort of nutritional fads, for example, yogurt with probiotics, which I think most yogurt has that already in it.
It's built into how it's created.
But there's things like kombu drinker.
Kombucha? I don't,
or acai berries, I'm not sure.
Acai berries?
Yep. brewer's yeast. You know, there's just like a whole list of things. And I wonder if all those food additives are actually necessary if you're buying, you know, whole grains and fresh fruits and vegetables and lean protein.
Yeah, I think they're sort of categorized as superfoods, which sort of are foods that essentially serve a little bit of a higher purpose than just giving you the basics of what you need. So I think if your health is compromised, if your immune system is compromised, if you're somebody who's struggling with a severe medical issue, or perhaps if you've got digestive issues that prevent that absorption, your needs may be a little bit higher than the typical person. And having those kinds of foods in the diet are going to give you extra fortification. And very often, they taste good. They add extra flavor to your meals. They may add a little extra expense to your wallet. But in some cases, I think they can be a great boost.
So, Dr. Kwan, a question then is like, wow, I really love this probiotic yogurt. Is there such a thing as eating too much of a good thing? Too many vitamins, even?
There can definitely be a time when there's too much vitamins and too much of a good thing. Definitely moderation is key. Again, it depends on your medical condition. If you have kidney disease, there's an instance where you might not want to take too much supplements as it might put too much load or strain on your kidney filtration or ability to. So definitely there is a point where you want to reduce or not take too much.
I wonder also about vitamins. I remember hearing at some point, Dr. Kwan, about the possibility of too much vitamin E. I think that's one that you were supposed to eat carrots for, that there's such a thing as an overdose.
Carrots, I think you're talking about vitamin A.
I don't remember which letter it is.
There's definitely an effect if you do take too much vitamin A. Some research has utilized hundreds of thousands of units of vitamin A. But where it comes down to is if you're a female and you're planning to get pregnant or have a baby, having 10,000 IU or more can be kind of not beneficial to the fetus, in which it can cause birth defects. So there can be an issue with that.
And when we're getting vitamin A through foods like carrots, it actually is in the form of beta carotene, which is then converted to vitamin A in the body. And you really can't necessarily overdose in that way if you're getting it from sweet potatoes, apricots, carrots, things like that, kale, because the body will know how to excrete it out when it comes in the form of food.
So in that sense, it is healthier to get those things that you need, those nutrients, through a healthy diet.
Absolutely.
And if you do a multivitamin, there are food-based multivitamins, and I always recommend those over isolated nutrients.
So how do you know if a vitamin is a food-based multivitamin?
Luckily, it will say so on the bottle.
Where do you look?
Just right in the front, it will say this is a food-based vitamin. I can give you a couple of brands if you want.
Yeah, we can't do that on the air.
Yep, sorry.
So, Dr. Kwan, do you concur with Mary Purdy?
I always agree with a nutritionist. Food is key. I can't stress that enough.
Oh, thanks.
So essentially, the messages that I'm hearing for both of you is that you should first check with whoever is your healthcare practitioner about whether you even have a need for supplements. Is that the first step?
I think that's a great step because it can also save you money if you're taking a whole bunch of supplements and it's not necessary. You're wasting money. You're literally having very expensive urine in your toilet.
Yeah, and your naturopath or medical doctor or nutritionist can really tailor the recommendations to meet your personal individualized needs.
So don't just run off and buy one of every letter on the shelf at the
not supplement
store. I really appreciate both of you checking in with us. Dr. Calvin Kwan is clinical resident at Bastyr Center for Natural Health. Mary Purdy is a registered dietitian with Seattle Healing Arts Center. Thanks both of you for being with us.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Ten 20, a conversation with composer Lawrence Dillon in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hi, this is Melissa Block with NPR News. Together, KUOW and NPR bring you stories you won't hear anywhere else. Stories that go beyond the headlines and keep you inspired and informed. Your financial support makes this all possible. If it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. Thanks.
70 degrees in Seattle, expecting sun all day with an afternoon high of 80. Sunny again tomorrow with a high of 82. Speaking of the weather, how's this summery weather treating your garden? We'll get some growing advice from a panel of expert organic gardeners 15 minutes from now.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. The Seattle Chamber Music Festival wraps up its season this week at Benaroya Hall. For the past several years, the festival's featured premieres of new American chamber music, and that's made possible by something called the Commissioning Club. KUOW's Dave Beck, our composer, no, you're not our composer, you're our cellist in residence, joins me now to explain what this commissioning club is and who they commissioned this year. So
yeah.
Let's start with the club.
The club's been around since 2007, and they get leading American, we'll say North American too, I think there's a Canadian in there, that create new pieces of chamber music. This club gets together, they pool together the money, and they call on these great talents. And over the last few years, Christopher Theofanides, Gerard Schwartz wrote a piece, Laura Kaminsky, Gary Kalesha in the last few years. So lots of new chamber music coming from the Seattle Chamber Music Society.
So the premiere this year was on July 8th, a piece called Sanctuary. And tell us about the composer, Lawrence Dillon.
Lawrence Dillon, I want to say he's a young American composer because he was born in the same year that I was, 1959.
Dave, I'm sorry, middle-aged American composer.
He's alive and well, and actually was the youngest person ever get a doctorate in composition from Juilliard in 1985. And his list of teachers reads like a who's who in American music. Vincent Persichetti and David Diamond, Roger Sessions, Elliot Carter all helped shape the sound of Larry Dillon.
So tell me a little bit about Sanctuary.
Well, in this piece that we're about to hear, he's thanks to Bill Levy, the recording engineer for the Society, we have a copy of the premiere. And it's a very personal piece. It's interesting with the birth of the royal baby. There's a final movement in there that's called Pulse, and it's a study or contemplation of a mother's pulse and a baby's pulse. And the idea, there's a quote from Mark Twain about the idea of sanctuary. So it's sanctuary considered from many different perspectives, and the music is quite evocative, as you'll hear.
So you spoke with Lawrence Dillon.
I did. Larry came in and visited with me on the afternoon of the premiere of his new piece called Sanctuary, and he told me how he works with the Seattle Chamber Music Society artistic director James Ennis in the creation of a new piece.
Here's how it happened on my end. James Ennis contacted me a little over a year ago about this possibility of this project, asked me if I was interested, and I said certainly, and we talked through via email back and forth about what might be appropriate for the piece, what instruments, and he gave me very free rein to do whatever I felt would be worth doing. And I think I settled on the instrumentation, which is five strings, horn and piano, a septet, because I didn't know of any other piece that was scored for that grouping, and I thought it would make an attractive ensemble, an attractive color for the music. And I was interested in exploring something that I didn't have a template for. I couldn't go listen to the great works of, you know, Pachelbel for five strings, horn, and piano. So I had to kind of invent the sound I wanted for it, and that was really wonderful for me.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of commendation from critics and people who listen to your music about the different colors. You know, your interest in color. And was that something that attracted you to this particular combination, or?
Yeah, I think we're talking two violins, viola, cello, double bass, horn, and piano. And I saw this as an opportunity for a very rich ensemble, a lot of variety, but this kind of power that you wouldn't get from, say, a trio or a duo. So that's what I was interested in exploring.
Mm-hmm. Does the title Sanctuary tell us something about how the piece unfolds, about your state of mind or the spirit behind the piece? Or
yes, I hope so. The piece is, I was thinking about the idea of sanctuary. And of course, all creatures require some kind of haven to retreat to from time to time, to get away from whatever the pressures are they face. And I was interested in kind of exploring that idea through several movements. And it worked out to be four movements, each one exploring a different kind of sanctuary. The first movement is called Domed and Steepled Solitude. And that comes from a quote from Mark Twain, a letter he wrote the first time he visited New York City, and he talked about being a stranger among millions of his kind. And so the idea of retreating to this, what he called this domed and steepled solitude. And I thought that that was an intriguing kind of, what's the term I should use? It was an intriguing kind of model for the way a piece of music could unfold. And so I created this first movement where you have this conflict between this very clamorous kind of music and this very quiet, introspective music, and trying to find a way to resolve that, those two things with one another. I'm always very interested in, you know, there's this tradition in classical music of creating conflict and then resolving it. And to me, that's something that's very precious about this kind of music, is this idea that we set up a conflict and then we try to find a way to mediate and bring these opposites together. I think that's as important now as it ever was. In my life and in the world around me that I see. And so that's something that I'm always exploring musically. So the first movement is, as I said, it's this contrast between something very brutal and something very quiet and introspective. The second movement is called Winged Sandals, which is a reference to the god Mercury, the messenger god, and that was his form of conveyance. And it's the idea of finding a sanctuary, finding an escape through great speed, the fact that he was able to get from one place to another in no time at all. And also, I kind of like the idea of winged sandals. I mean, sandals are so comfortable. And if you had a pair of wings on them and they could take you anywhere, that would be just, I think, ideal. So the second movement is a scherzo. It's just a very fun kind of fast dance. The third movement is called Sense and Recollection, and sense is spelled S-C-E-N-T-S. So it's, I guess, a Proust reference in the sense that it's it takes this sensory impulse at the outset, just this single note that expands into this memory. And the memory is kind of this archaic sounding melody that becomes sung by the whole ensemble over the course of the movement. The final movement is called A Reliable Pulse, and this comes from my feeling, one of my deep-seated feelings about music, which is that, you know, the very first thing that we feel in our mother's wombs is pulse. It's our pulse and her pulse. And the infant's pulse is much faster than the mother's. And I think the relationship between those two different pulses is something that, you know, we spend months experiencing while we can't see anything, but we hear and feel that. And I think that music is the one thing that really taps into that that experience that we all share of various pulses and the way they interact. Of course, you know, the mother's pulse speeds up and so does the baby's, and vice versa. So there's this kind of wonderful symbiotic relationship between these different pulses that don't necessarily line up exactly. Hmm. So the last movement, a reliable pulse, is a kind of a sanctuary in kind of the way our inner vessels work. Yeah. and finding some kind of reliability to that.
I listened to your string quartet that has a movement called Swings in it. It seems like very much in the spirit of what you're just saying, because in that Swings, it's evoked by the image of children on a swing set or mm-hmm. people on a swing
yes.
set. But it also has you know, traditional fugues and counterpoint. And it seems to me that you're very much interested in, you know, original expressions of sometimes very old ideas.
You're hitting the nail on the head. What I really love is the idea of taking something that has some kind of solid foundation in the past and trying to figure out exactly how it relates to who I am now, who we are now, trying to connect it to the present. This has been a lifelong fascination for me. I heard someone, and I wish I could recall where this came from, but I heard a quote once a definition of creativity. Creativity is finding what's been lost and making it new.
Mm-hmm.
And I always love that. And I think there are things about our inheritance, our traditions, that we lose, even though we still have certain aspects of the tradition. We've lost some of the elements that made them vital, made those traditions vital. And it's important to revisit those and try to figure out what they are and how they can impact our lives.
Composer Lawrence Dillon, his composition Sanctuary for Piano, Horn, and Strings had its world premiere at the Seattle Chamber Music Society Summer Festival on July 8th, 2013. It was made possible by the support of the SCMS Commissioning Club. The group has supported the creation of several new works of modern chamber music now. Lawrence Dillon, thank you so much for visiting with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Dave Beck. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW.
Ten 35, a visit from our organic gardening panel just ahead.
Support for KUOW comes from Powell's Wood, a Northwest garden, presenting a storytelling festival Saturday, July 27th. Guest tellers include Donald Davis, Heather Forrest, and Margaret McDonald, with personal stories and folktales to entertain audiences of all ages. More at powellswood.org/festival.
70 degrees in Seattle, it's sunny, and the forecast says the sun is going to stay with us. We're going to reach 80 degrees this afternoon for today's high. Overnight, a clear sky, a low of 59, and tomorrow Wednesday, more sun with a high of 82. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:35.
It's Tuesday, and when you hear a forecast for sun and 82 degrees, you think, gardening. And it is time once again to check in with our Green Days gardening panel, who are in the studio. Laura Matter, a practicing horticulturalist. Laura coordinates Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. Marty Wingett's here. She's a Seattle-based garden and travel writer. And you can find her at her website, martywingett.com. And certainly not least, but last in this list, Greg Rayburn, the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. It's great to have you all here once again. And our phone number, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. And here's the selfish gardening question. I was moaning to Laura, Marty, and Greg about the fact that my tomatoes, while green and lush-looking, the blossoms just aren't really setting any fruits. And I guess, Laura, do I just rack it up as a failed year?
Yes.
Oh.
I would try again next year, see what happens. It could be your setting, as we discussed. I live in a sort of woodsy lot, and I try tomatoes every year anyway, and every year I say, oh, I shouldn't even bother because I get a limited amount of sun. They do get good sun, but it's not enough to set enough fruit to really make it worth the effort. Hmm. But they're good-looking plants,
yeah,
too.
So I should just appreciate the lovely green leaves.
Yeah. And it's a good tomato year, so you're going to find good ones out at the markets and, you know, from your friends.
Okay. Friends, I need some tomatoes.
Sun.
Yeah. And here's a related question from Judy in Issaquah. How much foliage should I leave when pruning my tomatoes? I've got tomato suckers. Do I cut them both above and below blossoms or not?
Well, the tomato pruning you want to do on indeterminate tomatoes, the one that sucker the most, you want to take extra suckers out completely right at the leaf joint where they're coming out, because you don't want multiple stems on them. You want to kind of open that up, have a couple of main leaders maybe, and then you know, let some of that fruit. If you have fruit on some of those already, you can leave a few. But, you know, too many of those is going to detract from the health of the plant.
So what that does is all the energy goes into those extra little branches.
Goes into what's already developing, yeah.
We're talking gardening. Did you want to add to that?
No, okay. I'm very bad about pruning out the suckers.
You just let them go?
You know, I do kind of let them go, yeah. But the tomato is not overly leafy and branchy. It's kind of sparse looking anyway, which, of course, goes back to what the two of you were saying about not having 8 full hot hours of sun.
Right, right.
No, I don't have 8 full hot hours of sun anymore. But I do really like tomatoes in the summer. Oh, well, there you have it. We can move somewhere sunny. 206-543-5869 is our number. And hi, Michael in Seattle. You're on the air. Michael?
Are you?
Oh, Rachel, I'm sorry. I've got too much glare on my computer screen.
That's
sorry.
Okay. I actually have a nice follow-up question. I have 3 pots of tomatoes on my deck where they do get 8 full hours of nice hot sun, and I do prune out the suckers, but I selected heirloom varieties, 3 different heirloom varieties, 2 60-day and 1 90-day. And I think the 2 60-day ones are the ones that have not put on any vertical growth since I potted them. They're both between 14 and 18 inches tall. They have fruit set, but one of them has 3 fruits. One is red and nearly ready to eat, but at this point, I don't see it putting on any more growth at all for the rest of the season. The third one is super tall, probably 6 feet tall, but not very bushy. And I don't really understand what these heirlooms need from me that I'm not giving them.
Ah, the lure of the heirloom tomato.
Do you know what varieties? Can you tell me what they are?
I think one of them's Matt's Black Cherry. Yeah, I don't remember.
Well, here's my question about that. Indeterminate tomatoes will grow like big and tall and grow like a vine, and they're the really, you know, rampant ones. And then a determinate tomato will grow to a certain size and stop. So if they've been put into a pot and then they grow and get to where they're, you know, ready to set fruit, they're not going to grow much more. And so, you know, the trick is to really get them growing well before that point to get them to be good, strong, big plants.
As far as I knew, I had chosen all indeterminate plants because I'm perfectly happy to prune. And so either the plants were labeled wrong or something.
That can happen. It has happened. Other than that, I would just ask if, you know, what your fertilizing practices were. I mean, it sounds like one really grew and the other two didn't. So, that's odd if you're doing the same thing to all of them. I would question the varieties and really what they're supposed to be.
Yeah. All right.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks for your call. And sorry I mangled your name, but now I fixed my screen so I can see what everybody's name is. Our toll-free number is 1-800-289-5869. It's Tuesday. We're talking to our Green Days gardening panel here on Weekday. And Carolyn's in North Seattle. Hello, Carolyn.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. First is about salal, which I have the little label from the plant, which I got at Yakima Fruit Stand. It's called Galtheria. Is that the correct name?
Yes.
And it Galtheria shallon. Anyway, it's a native plant, and I want to plant it partial shade. And the problem is the little one I got, I've had it for a couple weeks, and it seems to be drying out and dying, despite the fact I've given it a lot of water, and I've kept it in partial shade.
Yeah, well, if it's in a small pot, it really doesn't want to be in a small... Is it like a 4-inch pot then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So just get it out in the ground as soon as possible.
I would put it into a larger pot. I think I would step it up and then make sure to care for it. I mean, at least in my yard, if I have things... I go around and I do my watering cycle on my pots. Mm-hmm. And I put them in a capillary bed, which is a bed full of mulch that the plants can wick the water up out of, and those tend to get watered. Once they're out in my landscape, I tend to forget about them, and much more so. So, but if you remember to water it, it might be worth putting in the ground. But I don't have much hopes for it hanging out in a 4-inch pot for
it's
very
a small
long.
Pot. Yeah, I better do that like ASAP.
Yeah, and part shade is its favorite condition, so that's good.
Yeah. Okay, I'll do that. And then my thanks for that. My second question is about rhododendrons. I live in a complex which has green tree in its name, but I'm starting to call it clear cut because the industrial strength landscaping crew hired by the management company has basically in the last couple weeks commenced to basically chop off as many of the rhododendron bushes as are kind of obvious, and they've cut them down to stumps anywhere between 6 inches and a foot tall. And I spoke to somebody at the management company who said that that's good for them, and they had attended a garden seminar. I haven't had a moment yet to research this, but I just wanted to ask you if that's true.
Well, I wouldn't actually say it's good for, I mean, it's not something that they need all the time, but a drastic renovation of a rhododendron is possible, and they should leaf out all right. Were they too big for the space they were planted in? Were they rangy looking before they got cut down?
Not the one. The ones that they have cut down have been the ones that were in, more full sun without a lot of other trees around them, with no other trees around them. In fact, right against the sort of ends of the complex, these, three-story tall condo buildings. And they were not in competition with any trees, so they were fully leafed out. They weren't rangy, and they weren't diseased. But, when you get a crew of people who I don't think they have any gardening training except on the job, and they've just chopped these things down to stumps. It looks like, it looks like native forest cleared in like 1890, just...
Well, it isn't necessary.
Yeah.
But they should come back again.
Our, newsletter was reduce, quote unquote. But reduce meant entirely lop off.
Well, I hope that they come back. You'll have to report it to us next year. Carolyn, thanks for your call. We're talking gardening with Marty Wingate, Greg Rayburn, and Laura Matter. Our email, weekday@kuow.org or 206-543-KUOW. Hello, my name is Charles from Bainbridge Island. Our house has a backyard with a small berm and a line of trees that separate the backyard from a semi-busy road. The line of small trees that provide a pretty good block for general road noise, however, it's not as good as I would hope. Is there a good low-maintenance bush or shrub we could plant between the trees or some other suggestions on filling the shady areas between trees? We'd thought about bamboo, but the trees are pretty dense and we worry about bamboo growing too far into our yard.
Yeah, well, anything you plant there isn't going to reduce the road noise. It can provide a psychological barrier, which can be effective. Mm-hmm. But as far as actually reducing decibels, you're not going to get that from plants. That said, planting a diversity of different evergreen shrubs, and one of my favorites is evergreen huckleberry. And that's
would work well in the shade of those, whatever they are.
Yes, and staying away from bamboo is probably a good decision.
All three of you have a headache for yourself.
Yeah.
All three gardeners nodded. No bamboo, Charles.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that. We are talking gardening, and Rico, I know you emailed in last week, so we'll go right to your question. I have had a twisted filbert in a whiskey barrel for about 2 years. How long before it grows through the bottom, or is it already too late? And if it has already grown through, is there any advice on how to move it?
I don't think they're terribly, I don't think the twisted ones are very fast growing. So you don't want to pick up that whiskey barrel and find out?
Is that it? Is that the way to
Well, and it depends on how, you know, has the top of the plant grown a lot? Usually they do, a plant will put roots on first before it puts a lot of top growth on. But if it's only been 2 years.
Yeah, I'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Okay. So pick it up. Yeah. Rico, and see if you can lift it. If it has grown through, is there a way for him to transplant it, or is it just really that's where the filbert tree is going to live?
When it's dormant, yeah. You don't want to be moving it until sometime in November, maybe November through February.
So what would you do, like whack apart the whiskey barrel and then dig a big hole? How would you do
it? You might be able to just tip that and get that out of there.
I assume that there, you probably drilled a bunch of drainage holes in the bottom of the barrel, and sometimes the roots will go through that, but you just cut those roots off and...
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but wait, Rico, until the fall.
Yes.
Until everything is sort of wet again, which is not in the forecast for this week or anytime soon. Callers on the line to 206-543-KUOW. We go now to Kirkland, where Scott joins us. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I have some lupin out next to my street where it's nice and dry, and they seem to like it. And they bloom really well, except that once they bloom, I think they have powdery mildew all over them. And they look really bad now, so I'm wondering, is there anything, should I cut them down to their base, or is there something I can put on to the lupin leaves that would get rid of it? And I'd like to not use anything too nasty since I have a baby.
Yeah. These are, what color are these lupins? These something you got at the nursery and planted out there?
I think they all came from a nursery. Yeah, they're blue.
Oh, okay. Well, lupins are rather susceptible to powdery mildew. And one way during, not now, it's probably too late now, but one way to reduce powdery mildew is to, and this is something you might want to think about for next year, go out in the morning and wash off the plants. It actually washes off the spores, and you can control it that way. It's right now, I would say you could cut it down. You could cut the plants down, but you would need to water the area well, and then they would flush out with some new leaves. And I don't know what kind of organic control there might be.
I think the water is a good idea.
Yeah.
Most diseases actually are perpetuated by water, but powdery mildew is kind of an anomaly there. As Marty mentioned, it washes the spores off. They're airborne. They like humidity and this dry heat we're having, this heat that we're having. And then if you do that water, the film of water on the leaf also discourages it.
And you also have the benefit of watering them, which powdery mildew also tends to attack drought-stressed plants much more frequently.
So it sounds like water is your answer, Scott. Good luck with that. Our phone number, 206-543-KUOW, or toll-free, 1-800-289-5869. We go now to Joan, who lives in Seattle. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I have another tomato problem. I have raised beds in my backyard, and I have 10 tomato plants, and they get full sun. I have one plum tomato. I've never grown plums before because I don't like them. But this is a San Marzano, and so I decided to try it. It's in a 4x4 bed with three other tomato plants. I've got lots of tomatoes on them, and the plums are getting brown on the bottom. They're in the same soil. They all get the same amount of watering, and I have no idea why this is or what to do about it.
The plum, the fruit itself?
Yes, on the bottom. It's like, I guess, blossom end rot.
Yeah, that happens from uneven watering usually. Have you been watering kind of routinely? Or?
Yeah, I water just the ground, the bottoms, every 2 or 3 days when it's hot.
Okay.
Every other day.
You know, you might check the soil when you're done watering the next time you water. It's pretty deceptive. Sometimes we think we've watered enough, and you dig down, and it's dry underneath. And so if the soil is staying dry in the root zone, it can cause this to happen. It's a calcium deficiency that happens from uneven watering and dry soil.
But wouldn't it happen to the other plants? That are in the
Some things are more susceptible. So.
And also, do you have a lot of fruit set on the other three plants?
Not that much.
Yeah. So your plum is at a more advanced stage where it's susceptible to it.
But the other plants have fairly big tomatoes, and they're fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, yeah, check the soil, because that's what's going on, and that's really about what all you can do for it is try to keep your watering really deep and keep it constant so that the soil doesn't dry out too much in between.
Good luck with that. Thanks for your call. Lisa has a quick tomato question as well. My tomato plants, I'm so with you, Lisa. They haven't set fruit yet. Is it too late this year?
No, plenty of time. We're actually early with our tomatoes, so.
Okay. So,
you know, this is better than last year we were all saying, they're not growing. Oh, it's terrible.
Well, it was cold. Yeah, we don't have that this year. We're talking with our Green Days panel, Marty Wingett, who you just heard, Laura Matter, and Greg Rayburn. And go back to email for a second, which is weekday@kuow.org. Samantha writes, I have potted strawberries in my backyard with plenty of afternoon sun. They started the season off great with lots of strong fruit, but midway through, from about last month on, the berries have been developing small, dry, and shriveled, like ones you've left in the bottom of your fridge too long. Any thoughts on why and what can I do? I guess not.
Well, to you. No. Well, they do, you know, strawberries do sort of peter out anyway. Not sure why they would be shriveled. There are diseases that happen to them. I'm not really conversant with a lot of the strawberry disease. You can call the garden hotline, certainly, and ask them. Send pictures to them, or you can post those on our the weekdays page. We can look at them.
I'd be curious if these plants had been productive in the past with a different, larger fruit.
I think that's what she was saying. And then it just in the last month, they started being small and shriveled like the ones you find at the bottom of your refrigerator. So you can post that picture. If you're on Facebook, it's Green Days on KOW, and put a picture there, and the gardeners will look at it and diagnose. That's it. So take two pills and call us back in the morning. 206-543-KUOW. Hi, Bez in Tumwater. Thanks for holding.
Hi. I had two shrubs that just keeled over and died over the winter, because in the spring they were the leaves were just brown and shriveled, and the plant had no life in it. One was a burning bush planted right next to, at the same time, about 25 or 30 years ago. So the one burning bush was very healthy and fine, and the one next to it died. And then we have a lot of azaleas and rhodies, and I had an evergreen azalea of that same age just dry up and die. I seem to remember in the spring that the azalea had spotted leaves, but it had really good flowers. Both of them were surrounded by other things that stayed alive.
How did they die? Did the leaves kind of shrivel up from the base up or top down or from a limb? Or did you just go out and the whole plant was dead?
Yeah, that was it. Because I remember picking flowers from that azalea, you know, picking a lot of the white flowers. And so it was totally covered with flowers, but it was then, it just seemed to happen overnight, but I'm sure it didn't. But, yeah, it just was, both of them were the same way, that kind of, and I didn't notice about how the death occurred, whether it was, you know, going upwards or all at once.
Yeah, once they're entirely dead, it becomes a much greater challenge to try and diagnose why they died. Mm-hmm. So what I'd do is I would really keep an eye out for surrounding plants and see if something starts to become susceptible. You start to see changes happening in that plant, extra wilting of the leaves, discoloring of the leaves, that sort of thing.
And also check the base of the trunk of the shrub. Look around and see if there's any damage to it. You know, you never know. Something might have been gnawing at it.
I was wondering if there was perhaps a mm-hmm. creature mm-hmm. of some kind. Good luck with that, Bez. Let's see. Laura wants to know, is watering a vegetable garden with high iron content well water good or bad?
Well, wow. I don't know.
Well, your plants won't become anemic.
All right, we'll move right on. Last question from Linda, and this is another tomato question. I have 4 tomato plants in whiskey barrels. They were the admiration of the neighborhood. Huge, lots of tomatoes, but the leaves began to curl. A friend told me I had spider mites and to pour soapy water over the plant. I did so for 2 days. They look terrible now, droopy, and when I water them, the detergent makes a soapy mass. Did I kill my plants?
Maybe.
Ouch.
You can actually see spider mites, or at least see their little webbing and stuff, so yeah. You can look first before you.
You can also spray water on plants to deal with spider mites because they like dry, dusty conditions. But in terms of making your own insecticides, you know, be careful with that because soaps are powerful and you don't want to use detergent-based soaps anyway.
So, yeah, it's the type of soap
yeah.
perhaps
and
that's
if
used.
You're pouring it over, you're pouring it into the soil mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. So,
sorry, Linda. Oh, that's sad. Well, with that, our dash through horticulture has come to an end. Laura Matters, a practicing horticulturalist. She coordinates Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. Marty Wingett, Seattle-based garden and travel writer. Find out more about her and her books at her website, martywingett.com. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Have fun gardening this week.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Our show produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Willett's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Robert Horton will be here tomorrow, as will Vaughn Palmer. Hope you will be too.
An in-depth look at the deep-rooted problem of racial prejudice in America is 15 minutes away. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Jerry DeWitt spent years working as an evangelical preacher, but he found himself asking questions about his faith, doubting his own beliefs.
I had found doubting to be a nightmare. My years of struggling with belief was something I wouldn't wish on anyone.
Coming up on the story, A Preacher's Path to Atheism.
You can hear that this afternoon at 2 o'clock on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, fresh brewed compost tea daily, and Baker Creek seeds, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
Later today, what does it mean to be a woman, and how has that changed over the years? KUOW's Ross Reynolds is going to talk about it with a professor of gender and sexual studies.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.